Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. As this afternoon, November 30th, 2020, we have a special Courthouse Steps oral argument Teleforum on a case recently heard today in Trump versus New York. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our expert. And we're very fortunate to have with us this afternoon Professor John Baker. He's Professor Emeritus of Law at the LSU Law Center. He's been teaching by Zoom as a visiting professor this fall at Peking University School of Transnational Law. Professor Baker's work on the census dates back to the last census, when he published an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal called Our Unconstitutional Census, and was one of the lawyers representing Louisiana in a challenge to the census. In 2019, he spoke at Federalist Society events and wrote op-eds on the citizenship question and Supreme Court decision. More recently, he's filed an amicus brief in the case we're discussing today on his own behalf with the assistance of Professor John Eastman. And he has just published a piece on SCOTUS blog, and it's available on the Federalist Society webpage that's promoting this event. So go and check that out for more of Professor Baker's thoughts. So after Professor Baker gives some opening remarks, we'll have a time for audience questions. So be thinking of those and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. Okay, without further ado, Professor Baker, thanks for being with us today. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Nick. Well, I just looked at an email I got from The Hill, and the title of it is, or the headline is, Conservative Justices Signal Willingness to Let Trump Proceed with Immigrant Census Plan for Now. I hope that what I am able to offer you is a little more insightful than that whole article that follows. In any event, it was an interesting and, as Justice Alito said, frustrating time this morning in this argument. The argument ran 80 minutes, which is longer than usual, and it concerns the president's executive order back in July that he wanted from the Department of Commerce and specifically the Census Bureau a list or numbers related to the number of illegal aliens in the country, to the extent that this was feasible and consistent with law. So immediately litigation followed from that. The way I would summarize the argument this morning is that it focused more on the justiciability question than it did on the merits, and that really is the basis for, I think, what the headline in The Hill was. But it wasn't just, quote, the so-called conservatives. I mean, this was a real conundrum for all of them, and there was a lot of follow-up from one justice to another, regardless of ideology, because simply getting to the nub of the problem is difficult, and that's why so much of the time was spent on the justiciability question. The question of the president's power to do what he wants to do was touched on, and I think and wished it had been touched on more in one sense. But as I go along, I think I'll be able to show you that that is a minefield yet. So just a little background on what happened. So I mentioned the executive order by the president in July, exactly July 21st. Well, on July 24th, only 3 days later, this suit was filed. And this wasn't a single plaintiff. There were multiple states and nonprofits involved. They must have had most of their complaint already written, even before the EO was published. Maybe they got some kind of a leak from somewhere that it was coming, because I don't know how they would have been able to put all this together that quickly. But they did. So they invoked a three-judge court pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 2244. For those of you old enough to remember, three-judge courts used to be quite common on constitutional issues, but Congress reformed that really at the behest of the federal judiciary, because three-judge courts get an automatic appeal to the Supreme Court. But in election matters, obviously, they're very timely, and so it is appropriate that there be a speedy appeal to the Supreme Court, or at least a speedy, if there is a right of appeal, as opposed to certiorari, and there is on three-judge courts. So on September 10th, the three-judge court in New York issued a judgment, a declaratory judgment, and an injunction, a permanent injunction, in favor of the plaintiffs and against the government. On the justiciability issue, at that level, it was primarily a standing question. And the three-judge panel found that, quote, President Trump's memo had, quote, a chilling effect on participation in the census. Now, this is going to be important because the justiciability issues are slightly different when they get up on appeal. Anyway, the court thought that the fear that illegal immigrants would have caused by what President Trump was doing was such that they wouldn't participate in the census. Or if they weren't fearful, they figured that there'd be no point in participating. So either way, the states were going to suffer some kind of an injury. And of course, the second point on standing is caused by the defendant. Well, of course, President Trump caused all this fear. And third, redressability. Well, the redressability was, they said, that their order would be sufficient to block the harm. In any event, on the merits, they found that the president's proposal of eliminating illegal immigrants violated the language that is common to the Reapportionment Act, the 14th Amendment, and Article 1, the original section dealing with apportionment. And they rested this on not only the statutory, but the constitutional language about persons. And it's important to come back to that later. The declaratory judgment went into effect. The permanent injunction was applicable to everyone except the president. Now, that issue got a lot of some attention in the argument, and the question was in part whether, even though the president wasn't enjoined, would he respect and follow the declaratory judgment? Anyway, this is a complex case, and it was fully reflected in the argument. Now, as indicated by the introduction, I have very definite viewpoints about these issues, so this is not going to be a completely detached explanation. But to some extent, we have to go over certain basics. And that is, on the merits, that question does not receive, as I said, as much attention as does the justiciability question. And for reasons that I'll explain, that may be good or it may be bad from my point of view and those who think that what the president did was perfectly defensible. Indeed, I go much further and say that his orders should exclude all foreign nationals. The SG, acting SG Jeffrey Wall, he did a very good job in oral argument, I thought. He knew everything. He had good answers to everything. And fortunately, from my point of view, he didn't get much into the merits, and that's why he had a good argument. Interestingly, he kept saying that he wouldn't be at all, you know, disturbed if the court decided to get to the merits. He wanted them to get to the merits. I think that was a big mistake, and I'm hopeful that they don't get to the merits. So let's go to the issues. First of all, as I said, justiciability. We have a new issue up here, and that is mootness, because the government is arguing rightly that the chilling effect no longer exists because the count in the field is over. And so whatever chill there was in the past, the weather has changed now. There's no more chilling effect. So then it came to the issue of standing. Now, most of what they were arguing in terms of the plaintiffs below is about what might happen, because nobody knows exactly. And that's for two reasons. One, the numbers are not yet available. That is, there's an involved process that we'll talk about a little bit as we go along, but they're not available. So we don't know at this point what the effect is going to be. And probably more importantly, there's no real way of knowing what the president's going to do. As everybody knows, he's rather unpredictable. So the argument on standing is there is no determination or ability to determine the harm, because at this point is much too speculative. Now, interestingly, in this discussion, there were several references to a D.C. Circuit three-judge court opinion written by Judge Katsas just at the end of last week. And his opinion is, as always, extremely thorough. And he came down on the issue of rightness, not standing, but prudential rightness in the context of the non-Article III. He didn't reach the Article III issue of standing. He went into rightness. And Judge Kavanaugh, at one point, went through an interesting discussion about the overlap between standing and rightness and distinguishing prudential rightness from other Article III issues. Only a federal courts person or somebody who's litigating this stuff all the time would really have a great deal of interest in that. But in any event, it was an important consideration as to whether they really ought to get into the merits of this thing, given so many uncertainties. And the certainties are going to, in large part, have to do with the number. So related to the justiciability issue is obviously timing. Timing. So what is the timing? By the end of the year, the Census Bureau is supposed to send to the president their numbers, what they've come up with. And the question comes down to, in a way, well, are there two sets of numbers? And what is the meaning of the census? And as the government brief pointed out several times, the word census is used in two different contexts. That is, census means gathering the numbers, and then census means the final numbers that are produced. The question involves the process that the Census Bureau itself goes through and hands off to the Secretary of Commerce, and then is relayed to the president. And then by the 10th of January, the president must send to the Congress a statement showing, one, the population base, and two, the apportionment for each state, the number of seats in the House of Representatives that they have. Now, it's really around this point that many of the justices are really somewhat, shall we say, uncertain. And there's a good deal of concern, I guess, about what it is they know and when they will know. So Justice Alito put it this way. He said, the posture of the case is quite frustrating. Meaning, as he went on to discuss, are we talking about a relatively small number? Are we talking about a very large number? And other justices picked up on this also. And Wall repeatedly said he can't say how many they will be able to match from the administrative records. Now, let me talk a little bit about what he's referring to, the administrative records. The administrative records have been used to adjust the numbers. So the one that I'm most familiar with involves college students. In the last census, I got a call from the Census Bureau saying, we see you have students in college. Are they in your state where you live, or are they in a different state? And I said, no, they're in a different state. Well, they didn't tell me, but I knew what they were doing. What they were doing is they were going to deduct the my children who are domiciled where I live, but who were attending school out of state. The Census Bureau has made the determination wrong, I think, that they will be counted in other states. This is part of the adjustment process that the Census Bureau does. And this process, often using administrative records, has been used for a long time, and the court in a previous case has approved it. So that's what's going on in part. Now, this gets complicated because when the president issued his executive order back after the citizenship case decision, he noted that at that point they had 90% of the administrative records already available to the Census Bureau. And that was due to the fact that the Commerce Department and the Census Bureau had been collecting some for a long time anyway. But the places that they didn't really have enough information were the State Department and especially the Department of Homeland Security. So the issue really was, well, what's involved? If you got these administrative records and you had them a year ago for 90%, shouldn't you have 100% by now? And what's involved in the matching process? There was an attempt by S.G. Wall to explain that, but it was never fully understood, I don't think, by any of the justices. And they were continued to say they didn't know how many matches they would be able to make, even though they were working as hard as they could to determine this. Now, the impact of that is that if the numbers are relatively small and we're not talking about a great deal that would shift a representative from one state to another, that's one thing. But as Justice Sotomayor pointed out, you know, you should know this by now if you've been working on this for over a year, and you say that you're going to eliminate as many as feasible and consistent with the law. And if that's a large number, it could have a huge impact. Now, that affects the justiciability question. How is that going to disrupt the whole process of redistricting? And is that a matter that can be dealt with adequately after the president sends the apportionment numbers to the Congress by January 10th? Is there going to be enough time? There was a great deal of concern about this and no clear resolution. And Wall honestly couldn't give them a resolution of it. So does that make a difference? Well, Justice Kagan thought that it was possible we're talking about 4 to 5 million people that might be in some way affected. But again, that seems to be a heavy consideration on all the justices. And then, as I mentioned, it's not clear what the president would do. In the argument made by the Solicitor General in the written briefs, I was very critical of in my SCOTUS piece, because he claims that the president has the discretion to eliminate illegal aliens, to do so selectively, and no obligation to do so. I mean, there's no standard to that. And on what basis are you saying you can do some but not all? And that didn't come up really in the oral argument. The Solicitor General was focusing on certain defined categories, notably at least some, he said at one point, at least. And he mentioned several times those who are being detained and are about to be deported. Now, this is where I don't think the argument in the brief is strong enough, because it doesn't really make a constitutional argument. And the problem with that is that the ACLU in particular, better than the New York Solicitor General, they are arguing that from the beginning, This is only about where you reside. And they're equating residing with inhabited. Now, the government brief says, well, it's not just residing. You have to have a connection to the place. The issue, however, is they did not really ever make a constitutional argument that was clear at all. And by the way, this whole situation, and it couldn't be said, the mess that's been created is due directly to the fact that the Supreme Court decided, as it did in Department of Commerce versus New York last year, when it said the citizenship question could not be put on the census. That's why they switched to the administrative records. In some ways, the administrative records may be more accurate, but if you don't have all the information you need in the administrative records, how are you going to allocate and eliminate certain people, but not other people, because you don't have sufficient information? That is the core of the problem. And the reason I think, as I think the Hill was indicating, that it is likely that the case will be dismissed on justiciability grounds is a great amount of uncertainty at this point. Now, I want to go to the merits question, which was only briefly talked about, and that is the merits question on the first go-around was only raised by Judge Barrett. And this is where I think the government may have trouble. I mean, we know that she is a textualist and an originalist. And they have not made in their brief, and they did not make in their argument, the kind of argument that a textualist and an originalist would need to go with their argument. When you first read the language of Article 1 and the 14th Amendment and the Reapportionment Act, you may think, as I did until about 11 years ago, that of course everybody has to be counted. But when you go back and look at the drafts of the Constitution and the use of the word inhabitant in those drafts up till the final draft, and the final form was not to change any substance of what the members of the convention had agreed to. And the Supreme Court has recognized this. And for the government merely to rest primarily on a statutory argument in the case of Franklin, it seems to me is a weakened argument, at least for originalists. If we get a decision on the merits without adequate explanation of the constitutional argument, I'm not hopeful about what the decision on the merits might look like. So, Nick, with that, I think I'll stop and take whatever questions we have.
Great. Thank you. So I'll wait a second here, Professor, and see if anyone comes to the front. Got a couple questions now. We'll go to the first one.
Hey, John, Jack Park. Thanks for the discussion.
Hey, Jack.
Isn't the fundamental problem with this thing that it's a political question? It's all and only about political power.
Well, it is about power. That's right. But it's governed by the Constitution and the Reapportionment Act. What they didn't do adequately is to distinguish between the statutory use of this on this issue and the constitutional one. In 1929, when the Congress, having failed to reapportion after the 1920 census, they kicked it to the Census Bureau and they created a statute to govern this. You know, it's another one of Congress's attempts to avoid accountability because they can't come to an agreement. And what some of them had the assumption that you had to include everybody, but not all had that assumption. And as Congress usually does, they write legislation in such a way that doesn't decide clearly or lay out clearly what law they're actually laying down. So over the years, for most states, if they're not facing in the immediate census results a change in representation like Louisiana did in the last census, like Alabama is facing after this census, they don't care about that aspect. They ought to, because the constitutional purpose is all about and only about representation. Congress has freighted the census results with statutory purposes of allocating funding. And for all of the other groups and states, that's the most important thing. That's why students are, when they're from other states, they're still signed up in the state where they're going to college. All of this has been decided by the Census Bureau with really not much, if any, input from Congress. It's been a political game within the Census Bureau. So you've got the problem that we have a statute that ends up allocating funding, and it may well be that illegals should be included for purposes of funding. But it's not just illegals. It's foreign embassy staffs. It's foreign students. All of these people are included. And fine, that may be okay for funding because they're putting costs on the jurisdiction. But there is only brief reference by the government to the issue of representation. And in fact, the ACLU had the guts to say that illegals should, they're here. They need to be represented. Wait a minute. You know, what right do illegal aliens or even legal aliens have to be represented in our Congress, have to be represented derivatively in our Electoral College? That issue never is clearly stated by the government. There's one paragraph at most in the original brief that talks about representation, but they pass up the constitutional argument and rely only on the case of Franklin versus Massachusetts and the statutory argument and the discretion involved. I think on the merits, it's a very weak argument.
Okay, thanks.
Great, we'll go to our next question now.
Yes, my question is, what is the impact of all of this on the timing of Biden taking office, if I may ask?
Well, it's supposed to be settled by January 10th. Okay, but if Trump does anything of what he has said he wants to do under the EO, there will be litigation that will follow. If Biden is in office, the litigation obviously will be run by a Democratic Department of Justice, which will not support, I suppose, what President Trump has done. But the reason why it's important to get it out is that states like Alabama that may be affected, they will be able to litigate even if the Department of Justice repudiates what Trump did. So we will, the court knows there's going to be more litigation on this. There's no question about that. And so that litigation will occur after the next inauguration.
Thank you.
Go to our next question now.
Yes, two questions. One, you said that Justice Barrett focused on the matter of the constitutional matter. Did she, in her questioning, or did any other justice discuss the distinction between funding and representation and the statutory versus the constitutional? Did any justice address that? Go ahead and answer that. I don't want to make it too complicated.
There were some separate questions, not many, about funding. But nobody mentioned a distinction between the two. No, they didn't. No one.
And I assume your amicus brief addresses that issue.
It does. But who knows whether it got by the law clerk's screening. Now, I got to say this. Justice Alito was going down a very good line, and he got cut off twice by the chief. And the first time, Alito just ran by being cut off. And he started with, do you agree? It was great cross-examination of the other side. Do you agree that tourists should not be counted? Yes. And should illegals be, forget how he did it. Anyway, he went from tourists to a tort. Well, what if the tourist then overstays his or her visa and is arrested and is in jail? Should that person be counted? And he got those two questions out, and there was a waffly answer because the advocate, I think it was Ho, but it may have been Underwood, recognized where he was going, because his point is, okay, you can't count a tourist here, but if the tourist overstays the visa, then you can count him. That's where he was going, but he got cut off. But at least he got the second question out after the chief tried to cut him off the first time. And he wasn't trying to cut him off. I'm not implying he was cutting him off because of the content of the question. It was a matter of time that was allocated to each justice.
Well, was there any recognition by anybody on the panel of the fact that the court, Roberts, created the mess that they're now trying to deal with?
No, nothing. Nothing. It would have been in politics for the government to do that.
I realize that. The only reason I ask is because Justice Alito's speech to the Federalist Society a few weeks ago did, in fact, read between the lines, very clearly express some strong irritation with the recent behavior of the court. And I thought maybe that might have surfaced a bit today. So.
No, but hopefully it surfaces in the conference and among the different justices as they deliberate.
Well, thank you. Good luck. I hope they read your amicus.
Yeah, but it's got to get by the screening pool. Either it did or it didn't. I don't know.
Well, John, we don't have any questions in the queue right now. So I'll hand the floor back to you if you want to cover anything. We actually do have a question.
Let me cover something before you. This is a short one. So in the first questioning around when it came to Justice Barrett, she referred to undocumented workers. And I thought, oh, no. And then it must have been after that, although possibly before. Justice Sotomayor kept referring to illegal aliens. So the next time it came around to Justice Barrett, she said illegal aliens. So presumably she was trying to be polite as she entered the new circumstances of her life.
Our next questioner.
Yeah, I wanted to know who are the winners and the losers, depending on how the litigation goes. I'm assuming if illegal aliens are included, New York and California win and some other states lose. But how does it flush out?
Well, that's a good question. And we did some of the numbers back 10 years ago. If you wash out all illegal aliens, the state that suffers the most is California. And the estimates on how many they would lose vary from two or three to six or seven. And that's related to the numbers. The official number that's mostly bandied about is either 11.5 or 12 million, which is a ridiculously low figure based on other information. So there was internally, the Commerce Department, I was told, estimated that there were 25 million illegals in the country. And shortly after that internal concept or notion made its way among some people, then a Yale study came out and said there were they gave a large range from 16 million to 26 million, I think it was. But I know the upper end was 26 million. So if you do it this way, if you say that there were possibly 15 million. And you added to that the 4 or 5 million that legal aliens, or you take that spread and you go up the other end of 26 and you add 4 or 5 there, let's say 30. So for foreign nationals, we could be talking between 20 and 30 million. During the last census, the apportionment included in each congressional district approximately 750,000 people. Well, just do the math and see how many seats, if you packed them all into the same district. I mean, it's a huge number. The amount of representation that foreign nationals have in the Congress and the Electoral College, you know, is approaching 10%. I mean, that's outrageous. And then when you spread them out in districts, as they are, there's actually more influence. Because if you've got a sizable amount in any congressional district, the person running for office faces fewer voters and yet knows the influence of those numbers because of the relatives who may be citizens and simply all of the other circumstances of cost that they want more money for their district. So it has a huge impact, especially in California, but it also has an impact in Texas and in Florida. So Texas and Florida, red states, they would lose as well. So it's not purely a partisan thing, a Republican versus Democrat. Yes, California is prominent, and yes, New York is prominent, but there are other states as well. Probably on balance, the Dems would lose more than the Republicans, but not probably that many more. And some years ago, I asked a prominent political consultant, Republican from Virginia, about this. And I said, why don't the parties do something? He said, well, you know, we consider it a wash. And so why bother? Well, wait, what about the Constitution? What about the concept of representation? That doesn't enter into the calculus of a lot of, quote, practical politicians.
Thank you.
Okay. And we don't have any questions in the queue right now, Professor. Oh, and we just got one. Asking you shall receive. Okay.
Professor Baker, thanks for the talk today. A quick question. There seems to be a consistent theme over the last 4 years of what I think charitably one might call bad lawyering for some of these arguments. Is that consistent from your experience with previous administrations, or is there a flavor here that the lawyers being asked to make the arguments are just having trouble getting there? In other words, they just don't believe in their own arguments that they're making. And is this sort of normal that arguments, like you're suggesting, the difference between representation and the budget allocations, that there isn't a good distinction made there? Because it seems like those kinds of gaps have been occurring more and more, but maybe that's just from so much media that's occurred the last 4 years.
Well, I think that's an outstanding question. And if I had planted a question, that's one I would have planted, but I didn't plant it. First of all, let me say that Wall is a very talented, bright guy. As I said, he made a strong argument. I know that in the administration, two things are going on. One, there was a struggle, I'm told by others, between making the constitutional argument or relying on Franklin. Now, certainly any argument anybody would have made here should have cited and relied in large part on Franklin, but not exclusively on Franklin. Now, I don't know what the debate was internally, but I think the uncertainty of the ability to finally do all of the matching was a big factor, I'm certain. And I must say that I do know that in the Census Bureau, there was a lot of resistance to all of the things Trump wanted to do. They didn't want the citizenship question, and there would be no reason why they would want this, because they have been dogmatic that what they've been doing for years is the right thing under the Constitution. And so, ironically, it's the Census Bureau that is making the constitutional argument that lines up with the ACLU. And so they're invested actually against the president on all of this, the majority of them down in that Census Bureau. But what they've been doing for years in the Census Bureau is all about money. They have let the constitutional issue to the side, and it's driven by funding issues. So that's one thing. And I don't know exactly what the, you know, all of the considerations that went into the deliberate choice not to make the constitutional argument. And I know it was a deliberate choice. So there may be legitimate reasons. And the brief was done, at least at the lower level. It would have been done before Justice Barrett was confirmed. So that may have had an influence. But not all members of the Federalist Society have followed Justice Scalia's lead in understanding the structure of the Constitution. And we've got people who know cases and they can read a text, but they don't understand the structure. This is a structural argument, and the structural argument was not made. And I actually tried to get through to DOJ through a friend who was in DOJ, and he was told, don't talk to anybody on the outside. Well, guess what? If there's a Biden Justice Department, you will not find them in not taking in input from their friends on the outside. This DOJ apparently won't do that.
Okay, we've got a next question.
And thank you, Professor, for an excellent summary. I love counterfactuals, and I wanted to ask if this argument had taken place, let us suggest, 200 years ago, with would slaves have been entitled to representation? And would
yes.
Indians have been entitled?
No, Indians not taxed were not. Look. The failure to go into the history and the text and the meaning of inhabitant, I don't know whether they were just unwilling to do it, but here's what the problem is. Historically, over time, at the beginning, we were encouraging immigration. George Washington complained that the first census was too low. We had more people than that. The beginning, although Congress had the power to naturalize, the states, as states, had the power to confer state citizenship. That's why slaves were not citizens, because the compromises in the Constitution left them with the power to determine who could vote. But the anti-slavery people in the Constitution, Hamilton and Gouverneur Morris, especially Gouverneur Morris, who wrote the last draft, he didn't want the word slave anywhere in the Constitution. And some people said, well, thought that they were just trying to hide it. No, he didn't want it to stain the Constitution. That was the whole point. In any event, the slaves and indentured servants were counted as inhabitants. And over time, I mean, back then, women didn't have the right to vote. They were citizens and they were counted. So inhabitant meant more than citizen. And today it means more than citizen. It means citizen and permanent legal resident. That is somebody who has a green card, somebody who actually is here not only legally, but is on a track where they can become a citizen. They are U.S. nationals. When you come into the country and you're in an airport, there are two lines, one for citizens and permanent legal residents and one for everybody else. If you're not a citizen or not a permanent legal resident, you're not an inhabitant. You're not in our political community. In the beginning, states were able to invite people to come in, and they wanted that, and certainly the territories wanted it so that they could get statehood. So if you cross the Atlantic in a ship, chances are you're staying here. So at the beginning, yeah, you were residing here, and the government simply says, well, you have to have a political connection or a loyalty to the country. Those who have studied, those who are lawyers, went to law school, who remember civil procedure and the diversity of citizenship, the whole issue is, where is your domicile? You can have multiple residences, but only one domicile. That's your permanent legal residence, at least for the time. It's the place where you have lived, and if you're not there now, you at least intend to go back to. That concept, which equals inhabitant in some of the dictionaries, totally ignored here. And it's a complicated argument, but Wall did argue that for the first century, immigration wasn't an issue. Even at the time of the 14th Amendment, there were no limitations on immigration. So somebody who came here and was going to stay in permanently, which they could do legally without a visa, then they were considered an inhabitant. But all of that changes once you start getting restrictions on immigration. We now have a new category between legal and illegal. Not everybody who is here is an inhabitant. And then when you add air travel to it, which is relatively recently, then you're getting many more tourists than you ever had. The phenomenon of foreign students coming into the country. All of this changes, and these distinctions are not being made.
Well, just as a follow-up, how did the states lose their power to grant citizenship in the state?
Well, you still can, and we still, it's not done formally, but for federal court purposes and diversity of citizenship jurisdiction, where you are domiciled and what state are you a citizen is still an important question. The 14th Amendment that makes everyone born in the United States a citizen, born in the United States under the jurisdiction of the United States, a citizen, gives priority to that, whereas in the past, the states would have been primary in terms of at least citizenship and voting. That changes with the 14th Amendment and certainly the 15th Amendment on voting. So what happens over time when you go from the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, the 19th Amendment, the vote for the women, and the 18-year-old vote amendment, I think it's 26, we tend to equate citizenship with voting. If you're a citizen, you get to vote. Well, that's not true. Those under 18 have no right to vote, but they're citizens. Permanent legal residents have no right to vote, but they're inhabitants. So representation, although it's close to being equal to the right to vote, it's not equal to the right to vote. When you count foreign nationals in the equation or the basis for apportionment, you are saying they are inhabitants and they are entitled to representation in the House and the Electoral College. That is the argument that needs to be made, and the government didn't make it.
Oh, thank you. Very interesting.
Thank you.
Okay, Professor. I think we're all out of questions, so I'll send back to you any closing remarks you might have, and then we'll close it out this afternoon.
No, I just, if there is any reference in any of the opinions to the merits in this case, I hope it's not a majority, because there really needs to be far more briefing on the question of inhabitant and who is entitled to be included in apportionment. My position is that we have to exclude all foreign nationals, which would mean that commerce, either through a citizenship question next time or through more complete administrative records, is going to be have to be able to get those numbers in order for it to be possible to restrict to those who are U.S. nationals to be being included to the apportionment. that is separate from the statutory question of granting money based on what the census numbers are, which include all foreign nationals. That's a question for Congress. Congress wants to distribute more money to different states. They have the perfect right to do so. That's separate. Now, as a policy matter, that may be not a good policy, because then it encourages states like California to entice more foreign nationals into their state in order to increase the amount of money that they're receiving from the federal government. So with that, I'll end it.
Great. Thank you. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, Professor Baker, I want to thank you for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise this afternoon. And thank you to the audience for calling in for your great questions. As always, we welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. Keep an eye on your emails and our website for announcements about upcoming Teleforum conference calls. We've got a busy week at the Supreme Court, so be tuning in for our Courthouse Steps oral argument reviews. So thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.